life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Here we go. Another week, another episode, another great conversation with an interesting person that I really enjoy and can't wait for you to get to enjoy. Just know this, though. I'm sore as shit right now. Like, I'm trying to get myself back into some reasonable and presentable physical shape, you know? In case a couple things I got in the hopper work out and I get to be on TV. I can't look like this. Can't look the way I am, or I will not enjoy watching myself. I look bad. I hide it very well, I think, because when I am on camera for, you know, social media or whatever, I can control what gets shown and what doesn't. Put my whole body on there. Yeah, it's not going to work. So I've been trying these morning workouts, man, and my body's rejecting them. My body just wants nothing to do with them. It wants nothing to do with physical fitness in general or bettering my physical appearance in any way if it involves work or sweat. It's looking at that weight bench and it's like, what are we doing? That's not a couch. It has weights on it, and those weights are heavy. We don't want any part of that. And in turn, it's making me so sore that it's trying to kill my will to continue doing that. I know it's strategy. I've been here before. It's worse now because I'm 52 and I think I feel things a lot worse than I used to, but I'm not going to let it get the best of me. I will continue to fight through it until I hurt no more and my body looks halfway presentable on camera. Tom Simmons is my guest. Tom's a longtime friend of mine. I first got to know Tom probably when I was 6 months into comedy. He was a guy I looked up to, so funny, such a great writer. You know, he was just really, really a good person to emulate at that time if you were a person starting out in comedy. And he's still that way today. But I wanted to sit down with him, and I wanted you to get to know him as well in case you don't already. He's a guy in my life. We talk on the phone quite a bit. I mean, at least more so than most of my comedy friends. We talk a lot, and sometimes those conversations are deep. So I feel like I know a lot about Tom. At least I did until we had this conversation. I learned a lot more about him. It's amazing what you can learn about someone if you just sit down and you just talk openly for an hour. And that's pretty much why I have this show. So let's tell you who Tom is. He doesn't have a website. No website. But he does have a Wikipedia page. Now, a lot of my friends that are like my true friends in comedy don't have Wikipedia pages because we're just not famous enough. Like, I don't have a Wikipedia page that I'm aware of, but Tom has one. So let's just browse through that, shall we? Tom Simmons, it says, is an American stand-up comedian and nationally touring comedy club headliner. That is accurate, although it needs to be updated a little bit because he also works a fair amount on cruise ships. So I would add that to nationally touring comedy club and cruise ship headliner. Next category, notable works. In 2009, Simmons won the San Francisco International Comedy Competition. That is true. I know that for a fact. Next paragraph. He has appeared in BET's Comic View, Showtime's White Boys in the Hood, and Comedy Central's Live at Gotham. All also true. That needs to be updated a little bit. He's also been a writer for 3 seasons now on the hit TV show, The Ms. Pat Show. I don't know why that's not on here yet. We're 3 seasons deep. Tom, if you have people that are contributing to this, get them on it. If not, if you guys are listening and you have the ability to contribute, do so now. He's also been a writer for The Ms. Pat Show for 3 seasons now. Also, he is the host of the incredibly entertaining comedy podcast where he interviews people. A lot of times he has a panel. It's a really good show called Dumbest Tom in the Room. That needs to be added. Next category, personal life. Tom Simmons and his wife Serena live in Greensboro, North Carolina with their son Owen. True, although there are a couple updates on that front as well, as you'll hear in the interview. Then the last category, external links. It says external links. Really, the only one says official website, and there's a link attached to it. So I'm going to click on it right now. The domain name, TomSimmonsComedy.com, is for sale. Make an offer. Tom, you got to have a website, bro. You're not The Rock. Like, you're not at that level of fame where you don't need a website. Get your shit together. No one buy that, by the way, because he needs to buy it back. Don't listen to this and then jump on there and buy it and hold it ransom. All right? Tom's my friend. Don't do that. I might buy it. I might buy it right now, but I'll buy it as a gift, and then I will give it back to him maybe at Christmas time. Right? Actually, I should do that. I owe Tom a lot of money. That would probably be nice of me to do. All right, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, my very good friend, the incredibly talented Tom Simmons.
Oh, here we go, here we go.
Tom Simmons, thanks for joining me, brother.
Thanks, man. It's good to see you.
Yeah, we talk quite a bit on the phone, but I haven't interviewed you in a long time. You have so many cool things going on. Your comedy career is as good as ever, as strong as ever. You are a writer on a hit TV show.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Come on. But I want to get into the nitty gritty. You had a really fucked up childhood.
What?
That's my shock journalism approach.
Okay. Man, hey, so, you're a crime guy, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of my childhood, we had this discussion on my show early on about I was reminded of a time where a friend of my mom's and all of her children were murdered by their by the dad.
What?
It was at the time one of the biggest sort of murder, like mass family murders in Illinois at the time or something. And he beat him to death with a hammer. He beat like at least three or four kids. Oh, and he didn't kill her. He just killed all the kids and then himself.
Jesus.
Or no, he didn't even kill himself. Anyway, he didn't kill himself. He just killed all
the
kids.
I was going to say, killing yourself with a hammer. Boy, that's a lot of work. Jesus.
Well, I mean, you might be able to really, you know, one shot it with the claw. If you do the claw, maybe not. I mean, I don't know.
Listen, no, if you're committed, you can get it done. That's just a hell of a commitment. You know what I'm saying? That's not just pulling the trigger and waiting for something to go boom. That's like whack.
Yeah. I'm telling the story terribly because I messed up all the details. But it was one guy killed his kids with a hammer. And my mom, and it was a big news story at the time. My mom knew the woman. So she gathered us kids together. Because the thing was, the kids let the dad do it. They didn't fight back. And my mom's point was, hey, if one of us ever comes at you with a hammer, fight back. And they were like, that is trauma. And I was like, nah, that's just good advice, really, right?
What a moral lesson. Like, yes. What a way. Like, your mom, her ability to make lemons out of lemonade, to take something so tragic and horrible and make it a positive contribution to her own household.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
What a woman.
That's what I say. You know what I'm saying? I got a lot of pushback from everybody else about how awful that is and traumatizing. And you're like, you know, but I'm with you. I think that's good momming.
Yeah. I mean, you know, make something good of it. That's what she was saying. There's a lesson to be learned here. Don't let us beat you to death with a hammer. I know I always tell you to do what you're told, but in that instance, the line gets crossed.
There you go. Like so that addresses your intro on my childhood.
I love your mom. Also in your childhood, this has always fascinated me. Your sister was one of the world's top figure skaters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was. Jackie Farrell. She was really, really good. Yeah, she was good. So that and a divorce, you know what I mean? It led from me a Long Island divorce, moved to Illinois, blah, blah, blah. And then my sister started getting good at figure skating. And she got better and better. And then it always seemed to be like that my parents wanted her to have the best coaching or whatever. And then she would go to a place and she'd be living with somebody around that skaters community and be with that training thing. And then part of the family would move to there. And then she would go to another place. And it's sort of like that. We sort of followed her around, you know, as she got better and better at that. And then, yeah, she was good. She beat Katarina Vitt in 83. That's sort of the name people remember. And then she was in the era, like, I was in that era of, like, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s figure skating. Like, you know, those guys, like the David Santees and Jimmy Santee and then Scott Hamilton. Those guys were always, like, around. They were either living in our house or I was playing them in tennis or I would always be at the rink and see. I can't skate a lick, but I was kind of around them a lot when I was younger.
I mean, that was the heyday of figure skating, and we'll cover this more on my new podcast about figure skating that'll be starting next month. But but what a goddamn, she beat Katarina Vitt. Like, what a thing. Like, to have a sibling who is not only internally considered one of the best in the world at what she does, externally recognized for being one of the best in the world at what she does, like recognized by the world as one of the best in the world.
Right, right, right.
And here you are, not one of the best in the world at anything.
I know, it's really depressing. You know what I'm saying? It's really, you know.
I only say that because that would be like a real, you know, psychologically speaking, if I was some kind of therapist or something, I might say that's a real voice a little kid might have in their head when they are the sibling of another sibling that is in that position. Like, was it tough? Like, did you feel like you were living in a shadow? Or were you like, no, this is awesome?
Your childhood is what it is. So you don't think, oh, it's this or that. I didn't consider, like, you don't have the same thing as me. That's just what it was. We were sort of a family that was together and then not together. And then she was off doing this thing. And I was proud of her, but I was she was just my sister. But it was a lot of work and there was a lot of yelling and stuff like that about not working hard enough and blah, blah, blah. So just the struggle, like that thing, when you're in the top 10% of something, like, it's hard enough just to get to there. And then what it takes to beat the best of the best, it's to people, you don't fluke into that. I mean, there was a lot of like battling for like going to see sports psychologists and learning early on. Like, I remember early on learning that what a lot of athletes now know, which is that sort of how the mind, she would listen to her program and watch herself landing every jump. You know what I mean? So you sort of build that mind memory of how you're doing things. I remember John Smoltz having to go through that with early on in his career. Like, he'd get flustered and not be able to throw strikes or whatever it was. And then that sort of train your mind mentality, it was sort of new back then when she was trying to do it. Cause she sort of had this thing where she, like, my son has this thing as a pitcher. That thing where in the biggest situations with the most pressure, somehow that kid just steps up and has it. You know what I mean? Like, that's when he pitches. He's a gamer, right? Like, he's the guy. I can see that.
Yep. That's something I learned from Pat McAfee was these people that are, like you said, 10%, but probably top 0.05%. Like, that they have something different in them. Now, obviously it can be honed through sports psychologists and these other things, but they do have something that's different that the rest of us don't have. And that is that ability to be so focused because they are in a thing that literally offers no room for even the most minor of mistakes.
Or doubt, you know?
Or doubt. Yeah. More importantly, probably.
So my sister had a little bit of that, you know, that I think a little bit of that in big moments. She never had that best performance at the best at the perfect time, except in some of these overseas things where she beat Katarina and stuff. But it, you know, and you had to fight in that day in the things. There was always, they'd already basically decided who was winning before a lot of those contests.
Sure.
So when those, when they'd give out the scores, you know, Linda Frognani was going to win the contest. So if you had a better skate than her before her or in the group before her, they were only going to give you up to a certain amount of points, even if you were perfect. And then they saved all those other marks for a couple people, you know.
The dirty business of figure skating, which will be episode one on my new figure skating podcast called Figure Skating with Todd McComas. But do you feel like you absorbed any of that, or that you naturally have some of that too? Because I will say this about you. Among all the comedians I know, you're definitely in the top heap as far as, I think, work ethic, and you always have maintained a high volume of work, which is getting increasingly more difficult. But you seem to be, like, among my friends, one of the exceptions to the rule as far as always having work and work of value that pays well and you can maintain a good living. Like, all these things, do you attribute any of that to something you have inside that's similar to what she has?
It's weird. I've never thought that before. I don't know. I have.
Surely you do, because your son ended up with it, you know, like.
Yeah, my son ended up with it. I somehow just realized early on with him that, first of all, if he was going to play baseball, it's like, go get coaching. That's what I learned. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's, to me, what I learned was it's about repeating the simple basics and working on those, like the simplest things over and over and over. And I guess I relate it to comedy. It's like getting up and writing. It's, you have to put in the work over and over and over and over and over, and failure over and over and over and over. And you just have to just keep grinding. That's what it is. It's the everyday grind.
That's what I meant, because I see that. I've always seen that so much in you. You weren't afraid to get up every day and write and go to these awful mics and work and just to get two or three words right or whatever. Like, you're one of those dudes. You're one of those comedians. So
I feel like everybody's that. That's weird.
I don't think so.
How are you? Well, anybody that's making a living at it, and I don't write enough. I have, what I did get from that too is I get a lot of beating myself up for being a failure and not doing those things enough. Like, I look at a guy like Stuart Huff or, you know, a ton of comics, the content they put out and throw a whole show away and start over from zero. Like, I don't do that. I don't know how to do that. I can't. I tell myself I can't. And when I don't, and I look at my sets, I'm like, this is still jokes from blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't see myself the same way. And I get that from my childhood, obviously. Like, I see myself more as more, to be honest, unless I really focus on the things that I've been able to do and that I keep making a living at this. And I go through my resume, like you were to Miss Pat Show, blah, 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 like those. You're like, oh yeah, I guess I have achieved some things. I see myself as a failure.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabay. Anabay is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
I am a lot of the same type of person. Like, I always look at what I haven't accomplished or what I have had and have lost versus what I have in the present. Because it's always like, from other people's perspectives, they're like, well, what are you bitching about? I would love to be doing that. I would love to have that. But for people like us, it's like, really, it's probably never going to be enough, which I think is a good trait to have, because that keeps you progressing and evolving. And
I've never really thought about it. You're right, though. I think that does come from that, because I think if you really ask my sister how she feels, she was one of the best in the world.
Literally.
And I think she feels like a part of her feels like a failure because she wasn't the best. And I think she has that thing that athletes have, that I think comics have, I have a little bit of that. Like, I feel like that's within me. And she feels like that was within her. And it just wasn't there when she needed it to be, or like didn't get the right break or blah, blah, blah. But she's been able to also maintain and have, it's interesting, I never thought about us being similar, but that she's been able to sort of maintain and make a great living as being in skating through teaching. And she realized at some point when she was around 50, she was like, oh, I'm going to try speed skating. And then she was instantly one of the best in our country at that. She made nationals in that at 50.
Wow.
And she probably would have been in the top 5 or 6 if she hadn't got a concussion and then competed again too early after that. And she was still one of the top 7, 8, 9 speed skaters at 50. And, you know, so she realized, oh, I watching hockey and teaching hockey and doing power skating on the island, on Long Island, she realized, oh, I can outskate NHL players still. And she just knows the technicality of it. So she's made a living, and now she works for somewhere along in the Nashville Predators organization where she's,
there you go,
working with them on skating and blah, blah, blah. You know, so she's been, and that same kind of way, I've been able to keep making a living and doing well. And I get a job writing on a show, or I get a web series, or I get, somehow I keep fluking into these things that people pay me to be funny.
Well, fluking
and now I'm reinvigorated by it because I got my life, which is changing drastically. My son left for college, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I can now do whatever I want, you know, I realize. And so have I told you my latest crazy plan?
No, but I want to hear it so badly.
I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's crazy. It's just, I'm going to take my half of the, I don't even know if I'm going to do that. Anyway, I'm just going to,
do you want to say that you're going through a divorce? So we know, like, we don't have to go into the guts of it and the horrors and the trauma of it and how badly this cuts through you and ruins a good portion of your life. We can let's just say for context, you're going through a divorce, some assets are being liquidated, and this is part of what's happening right now as you are suddenly an empty nester.
Oh yeah, it's the longest divorce. It's been like 2 years, and we're still not separate. You know what I mean? Because we can't afford to live apart. So this is a crazy. This could be its own show. But anyway, so I think I'm just gonna leave with. I'm gonna leave all my stuff. Maybe get a storage room, maybe not. I think I'm just gonna grab some clothes and a couple books and very minimal. Just drive to another city. I think I'm gonna drive to Atlanta for the first 9 months, and I'm gonna work and comedy for 3 weeks a month, like off being a comedian and staying on the ships or whatever the club, and then be home for 7 to 10 days a month. And I'm not going to even get a place. I'm just going to get a hotel, which would probably be cheaper than right around what rent would be. And then I'd have no bills. And I just, I want to be a comedian again.
For people that don't know, I might have said this in the intro. I might not have, I don't know, but you work a fair amount of cruise ships as a comedian. So that puts you out to sea for like 10, 12 days at a time?
It's usually a week at a time, sometimes 2 weeks at a time, but I want to do it where I get to where I'm doing it 3 weeks, so 3 weeks a month. They're flying me around. You make better money than I make in the clubs. And
right.
And I'm just going to grind and work and work and work and get, and just like I used to say when I worked one-nighters driving around the country, it's like you can, and there was a big stigma of like, oh, you're a road comic. And I did go into New York and I'd sit in there working and begging for spot, you know what I mean? Like, and it's like, you got to get a job and go on auditions and I was like, I just want to be a comedian. And then it's like, oh, you're a road comic. It's kind of a thing.
The stink of the road, they used to call it, I think.
I bought a motorhome. I lived in a motorhome for a couple, 2-3 years with Serena, you know, when we first got married. And then, I'm just being a comedian was it. But I always thought if you work your comedy and don't get used by the road, I always used to say, if I learn to kill in these weekend rooms and one nighters, then you're most likely a bad comedian.
I think it means you're not testing yourself. Yeah.
My goal was to do was just keep writing and working and getting and working on. So that's what I'm going to do again.
Yeah.
But even in a more focused way, because I don't feel like I'm chasing fame. I just want to be a comedian. I want, so I'm like, I go there when I'm there, I just dive into like a cool scene, do all the podcasts, do all the shows, record as much as possible when I'm there, go back out for those 3 weeks, build another, like just keep building sets, you know? Right now we got to do 5 different half hours, 2 of them clean, 3 of them dirty, or we got to do like 5 or 6, 7, 8 different, you know, 40 minute sets during a week. So you got to figure out how to,
for the ships,
one's clean, one's dirty, one's, yeah. So it's like all, it's work and it's, so it's, but I love that, the puzzle piece of comedy and putting together. So, and now I'm to the point where I've figured out that I have enough material. Now I can start within that, start to write and grow, you know? So I'm really going to, I feel like I put it comedy to number 2 or 3 on the list, 2, 3, 4 on the list. And dude, you want to get to that next level. You can't do that. You got to be married to the game. So I'm going to do that.
Absolutely.
Just dive in and see how long I can do that before I break a hip or whatever. Or can't do it.
Well, it's interesting because I'm in that position now where I'm putting comedy 3rd or 4th, you know, in my list of priorities just because of other projects. And you do get to a point, like right now I'm starting to, at first I felt like I needed the break. And now I'm to the point where I do miss it. And I miss the things you're talking about. And to catch people up that don't know, when you're on a ship as a comedian, you have to have an adult show and you have to have a family friendly show. And then you got to have different shows at different lengths, depending on what shows throughout the week you're put up on.
Which line you're on, or which line, all the lines are different. Yeah.
So Tom's saying this is an opportunity. And it's what you're saying is it's an opportunity for you to construct that set that you're going to use off the ship, because you have to constantly stay updated anyway. Why not do it with quality and then build this awesome hour that you can use?
Right. But I got to be honest, and there is stuff that you can't do on no matter which. Not that you can't do, but I've always walked the line between, like, I think being able to talk about like big subject, you know, whatever those are, you know what I mean? But like
religion or, yeah, any huge topics.
Any guns, or really any of those, whatever it is, abortion. Like, I've been able to figure out in my mind, like, how to tell that to everybody, right? So sometimes I'll get on a ship and after I get off, they're like, oh, you can't do this topic or this topic or this topic. And then it's like, that's my set list you just sent me, you know? So
right.
And then the next time I'll do it, and then they'll be like, the review will be like, oh, we love Tom because he can talk about this subject and this subject and this subject in a way that makes everybody laugh, you know? So it's,
right.
It depends on who the person is. So I just have to ignore that and do my comedy, but I also have to be mindful of there's some stuff I can't, you don't talk about on. It's just, you can't take the chance. Like in a comedy club, somebody doesn't like me. It's like, well, there's the door.
Right.
On a ship, somebody doesn't like me. They're like, hey, Tom, there's the door. You know what I mean? Right. So it's a little bit different.
We're going to call a helicopter and you're going to get on it. And,
That's it.
Or when we pour, just go ahead and feel free to walk off into Mexico and stay.
Yeah,
there.
I haven't seen that happen, but they will not work you the next to anymore. But so, anyway, so it's just like a corporate. You got to be aware of there's certain lines that you don't cross. Where in comedy, that's sort of the fun of, is to cross that line. So that's why I want to have my foot in both and not just write for over here. You know,
right.
I want to also be able to, when I'm in a comedy city, I want to be surrounded by that area's the best in that area's game, and then use that to make myself better, and then pack my show up and fucking take, and then 10 months later I go to Austin and then I dive in there for 10 months and just do it in those weeks. And then just, it's a weird in that I like having a home. But I think I don't need it.
I think everybody reaches a point in their life where they would like a break from that. For however long it lasts, and maybe it'll last the rest of your life, who knows? But there's freedom involved with it. I remember, you know, I didn't start comedy till 38. And that was because that was an age where my son was able to just kind of stay at home by himself if need be. And I was going through a divorce then. It literally was like, in a sense, getting out of prison almost. Like, and not that everything in that life was bad, like being in prison, but
I feel
there
like there'd be more. I think I feel like I would have more sex in prison. You know what I mean? Even if it was forced on me, I hate to go there with it always, but
I feel like you would, though, to be honest. I do. I feel like you'd be popular in prison. You're funny. You know, you're not like physically threatening enough that you would dissuade someone wanting to have a party in your cell without your permission.
Yeah.
Like, so Yeah, I think you'd be very popular there. But I also think it would be very popular with this kind of hotel hopping kind of lifestyle. And you're a comedy monster, so you really focusing on it's going to be exciting to see. Now, seasonally, when it's time for the Miss Pat show, I assume you'll just park at a more long-term living place.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first season I wrote on Miss Pat, I was a staff writer, and then they put me up in some place that was way too expensive. You know what I mean? They put me up for the whole time and this thing. And I mean, it was COVID, and then the next time for seasons 2 and 3, I went back and, I put myself up. That's sort of where I got the idea, because I was staying in a hotel and I was like, oh, well, they come in clean. I have everything I need. I'm just on those in that situation. I'm literally just getting up when I would get up, getting a coffee, going into the studio. I'm there all day. I would drive from there probably and then try to go. I would mostly go to Laughing Skull and do a set and just a short set there, blah, blah, blah. And then I would go back to my hotel room, crash, and then get up and start all day. So it was just working, you know, it was like.
Now, how long is a season of a TV show like that? Like, how long is your contribution to it where you have to physically be there?
I'm not a staff writer anymore. I'm just doing the punch up on the show. So now, when you're the staff writer, you're probably spending three and a half, 4 months writing the season. And then the writers sort of all go away, except for a couple of them. And then they go and shoot the show. And then the writer that wrote that episode comes in for that week. And then it's like us, like me and Dion and Pat, like there's a smaller group that's then watching every episode. And then the Jordan and the head writer basically do most of the rewrites and stuff. But we're just pitching jokes nonstop. So okay. That's what I'm doing. Like I'm just sitting all day watching everything be done, reading the script and then watching it be doing the read-throughs and the run and the practices and the bumble. And it's just like nonstop. Let's go pitch a joke. Let's go, you know, and so you get on runs just like in comedy where it's like a lot of stuff in a row gets on and then you throw out a couple stinkers and then they don't trust you anymore. You know, and you got, it's just a, but at that the joke writing is what I'm best at, and then I resisted the way things are as in the writing room as opposed to stopping and being like humbling myself and learning a little more. So I was sort of a friction point. But I'd known Miss Pat for a long time, and I was overly insistent in my head of like, that's not real,
because you knew her intimately for a very long time. And plus, I assume you, because you have comfortability with being a true friend of hers for a long time, you felt like, not only do I know that's not authentic to her, I can say that out loud in this room right now.
Yes.
And I assume that wasn't always well received.
Yeah, it's just a different thing that I'm a slow learner at everything. So I contributed well. I wrote a good episode. Me and Pat's daughter, who turned out to be a really great writer and really knows her voice, you know what I mean? Even better mm-hmm. than anybody. But to be honest, in the writer's room, the first season, they didn't pay much attention to her. And then we have a character that's her. And I can't tell you how many times I'd just be like, can we just ask Garyana, what would you say in this scenario? Like, give us things from your life that had, because to me, Miss Pat going through the drive-thru at Chick-fil-A and you're on the phone with her is the funniest thing in the world. It's hilarious. Like she's just she has a crazy uniqueness to her, you know?
Right.
But, you know, but these guys, you're taking writing classes. They know what they're doing. It's a different thing, you know? So I've been learning that a little bit and getting, you know, so I wrote an episode in season 3 also.
Oh, nice.
So, but it's, mostly what we've realized is I'm a punch up guy. I'm a joke guy.
You are a joke guy. That's why everybody loves you.
So for that, yes, I would probably have to, cancel a bunch of work and do the show.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the debate. Then that's the debate I got to have in my head. What's more fun, going out and being a comedian or having a job writing on a show?
Right.
And they're really close.
The luxury of being able to do two different things that pay you well enough to live the way you want to live. Most people have to make those decisions because, oh, well, this one pays enough for me to live how I want to live and this one does not, you know, but what a luxury.
They're really right about the same. They're really, great. So it's, It is great, except in all honesty, what I love doing is the stand-up.
Right.
But what's better to help with the stand-up and to be and to continue to have the, because stand-up feels like, oh, stand-up always, for my whole life, has always felt like it could go away at any minute, you know?
So, right.
But then again, doing these things and taking yourself out of stand-up hurts the stand-up, you know? So it's a weird balance that I'm trying to figure out how to do, you know? And and you know, they could probably get two more people in there cheaper than they can have for me. But, you know, I average getting in a good amount of jokes on the show. So, you know.
Well, I always liked watching it because I could tell which jokes were yours. I wanted to hit my wife. I'd be like, Tom wrote that. Guarantee it.
I wonder what your percentage of being right on that is.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. We should play a game with that sometime. Yeah. Let me ask you this. Mentor-wise, like, in you coming up, like, who were your mentors in comedy? And maybe they weren't even comedy related, but the what you got from that mentor you were able to use in comedy. Like either someone really in your life who actually did help you, or both, if you want, someone that you idolized and said, I want to end up being like that person.
I mean, the first person like that in comedy that I felt that about was Hicks after listening to his, I somehow went on a Hicks binge and just fell in love with, you know, I'd probably been doing it 5 years at that time, but
I could definitely see Bill Hicks as an inspiration for you.
Yeah. I wanted to do like what him and Stanhope do, but keep people in the room.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. You not know? Walk half the crowd. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think you've accomplished that at some level, to be honest. You don't take the easy way out when it comes to subject matter. But you do have a way of making it digestible for everyone, regardless of their opinion on that subject matter, which is a real skill.
Yeah, I think I worked kind of hard at it because I had someone tell me early on, like I told a joke. It was friends of my parents, and they had supported me early on or whatever. And then I had this joke where I was making fun of. I was in some store, Christian trinket shop, and they were selling like Jesus figurines and stuff like that. And I was just like, this is just, you know, bastardization. And like, what are they, you know, they're just about the profit. Yeah, I could just see them sitting around in some corporate boardroom of the Christian, like, here, you know what? Everybody has sex. Christians have sex. What we need is some, what would Jesus do sex toward? You know, it was like, and I did this whole like, WWJD KY jelly, because hey, Jesus wouldn't fuck you dry, and they were like, and then so they literally handed me back the CD because they're like, and she was like, I'm sorry, I just can't support it, and I get that now, but at the time I was like, what do you mean? Like, it's just jokes. The major point of it is little, blah, you know, my whole
yeah.
And then she mentioned Sam Kinison, and she said she remembers when one of her kids was younger. Walking in the room and here Sam Kinison was doing some bit of like, come onto my children or something, come to with a play on the words come or whatever in a Kinison bit. And so she wouldn't let her son listen to, or she never listened to Sam Kinison. And I was like, you missed a lot because of that turning him off, your son, like he really was thoughtful within some of that stuff.
Right.
And so you missed all of that. And she just looked at me and she went, yep, I did. And so did he. And some about that was like, I felt sort of superior. And then I instantly thought, oh, she's right. Like, if there's a way to write that and get those same points across and keep them in the room,
then everybody gets to hear it.
Yeah, it just takes a little bit of compromise on my part. And then my little thing is in their head infesting them with my, that's how I used to think. Like I would, the idea of the bigger thing is implanted. They've already laughed, and now they'll think about that a little bit more the next time they're in that situation. I overestimate people. That's my problem. Like, I think people are generally good, and they want to do the right thing, and they're loving, and blah, 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 you know? And
first of all, you put way more thought into your comedy than I do. Which I admire that about you and Stuart and other comics who are really trying to tackle something or something bigger than a joke or convey a message about something that we should be paying attention to as human beings, where I'm just more like, boy, if this just makes the room laugh, it's good. Like that's a good joke.
I'm coming around more to your attitude, to be honest. Like I have less of that now as I get older of like, I got to change the world with my jokes. Now I'm just like, I want to, you know, now I just like, I don't hardly watch the news at all now. You know what I mean? I just, unless I have to, I used to watch it and read the paper every day and all that kind of stuff. And now it's just, because when I do, I'm reminded, like I was telling Seth earlier, like about the environment, like I just hate that I know what's coming and how depressing.
It's almost so. That makes it scarier.
I try not to pay attention to it because it's just more proof to me of like.
Yeah. I mean, it's much easier to just keep your head in the sand a little bit because we as individuals, the fact is we can't control any of that. We do not have enough power.
We have all the power if we get together, but we're not.
But we can't accomplish that.
I know. That's what I mean. I used to think that we could and that there would come a awakening and I would be a part of that. You know, that's the kind of mindset I had. And now I realize
that's always been our weakness as human beings. That's why we had kings and shit, because we could there would be no kings if the people would just get together and get on the same page and say, fuck that guy. We need to eat real food. And not have to create soups out of leftover, you know, bone marrow and whatever and else shit, you know, however we got those foods. Like if we just would have united, there'd be no kings. There'd be no castles with them living in it.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Yeah, I mean, and I used to think, well, all you gotta do is inform people and then they'll be, you know, I literally used to think if I've ever met a racist, I would just talk to him and I would show him through logic and reason and blah blah blah. And then you meet one and you're like, oh, that's, there's no change in it. There's no, it doesn't matter what the evidence is.
Right.
I think jokes sort of force that. I think that's what I have fun. Like jokes are the way of saying, here's your opinion. Here's the mockery of that. Here's blah, blah, blah. Here's a great point wrapped in a punchline, you know? And that's sort of, my mindset works that way. But early on, the influences that got me to really got me to that and the joke writing itself was, at some point I realized I needed to write and I needed to learn how to write. And then I started reading joke writing books. Like I read Jean Perre was probably the first one because I would walk around bookstores and stuff. And then I started finding like that, Melvin Heltzer. I just ate up whatever I could read on writing. Julia Cameron's Artist's Way probably had a lot of influence on me. Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art. I go back to those things here and there to remind myself, like, here's the process. These are the simple things, like the writing the joke, thinking of what relates to it, the cliches, like that's all that basics work that I'm talking about. Like somehow that's grilled in me. Get out there and work on figures. Do the right workout. You know, when you're pitching, work on your leg lift over and over. Like that's, and then to me, it's about putting pen to paper. You know, I think we all do over time. We train our minds to write jokes, you know? Or to recognize when we do write jokes. I think most people write jokes. They just don't realize it.
This is a real thing, I think. Like, I probably have 2 to 4 friends in my life that are good friends that are way funnier than me, that would be amazing comedians. Like, have what it takes, I think, to be you know, have a million followers on social media and have a huge podcast and just be a monster on stage. Like, they are funnier than me, but there's just no enthusiasm for this, the psychology and wanting to make that a job. Right. So that's, I think
it's like,
that's
I just said something funny. I don't need to write that down and then say it again.
Yeah. What are you talking about? Into... I'm the funniest guy in the Ford plant. That's all I need. Yeah. Right. So it is weird because to me, when I first discovered comedy, it was so bizarre that there were these people like you and every other working comedian that's their job. And I always, at first, you know, I'm like everybody else. Oh, their job is they just show up and just talk and say funny shit in this microphone for an hour a night or 2 hours a night.
Yes.
I didn't know that the job part of this was everything you've described up to this point, the getting up in the morning and work and studying and how can I better educate myself on how to perfect that formula of turning subject matter into something funny. It's so fascinating. And I hope people that listen to this find it equally fascinating. That's why I like to talk to comedians more than anybody else. But tell me about, all right, let's say End Road Wise. What, if you could right now end up anywhere in either of these careers or any of these careers you have going on, if you could just land one position, what would that preferred position be?
Comedian. Selling out theaters.
Like the Brian Regan approach, like you're that, known just for your stand-up. You can sell out arenas based on the fact that you're just one of the best comedians to ever do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I know I'm not the guy with the answers on any. That's like, you know, I've been through stage where I was like, I want to be like a Daily Show guy or blah, blah, blah. I would love to write for something like that, but I have no desire to be the guy that's speaking for people anymore. You know what I mean? But I do want to. The goal would be to be selling out comedy shows all over the country and having people that want to come see my comedy, you know? And it's interesting because I recognized last time I was on the ship, maybe two times ago when I was on a ship and I'm writing about it, and I realized, oh, there's whatever, 5,000 people on the ship, you know, over time, over the week, 1,500 of them are going to see my show. Yeah. Like, I literally, it's a microcosm. I have the ability to affect that culture for a week. Like, if I'm making the people laugh, or if there's a subject that just rips the room apart, all that stuff that I have that I've had in my head all my life of like how I want to have my words sort of change the attitudes of people. It's a microcosm. I can on those. Like,
you're doing it. Yeah. The difference,
like,
being
within that week, I'm causing a connection with, like, they all share that they're not, this huge chunk of those people have listen to my opinion and my jokes. It's changed how I've changed how I did it a little, or my attitude a little bit on the stage of like, oh, this is going to be so fun to be a part of this community for this week, you know, and I can affect that.
Great lesson for anyone in this industry, or for whatever you do, like in a real sense, you're already doing the thing that you would most want to do. The only difference, I guess, would be I'm doing one show and all 1,500 of those people are sitting down in that room for that one show. That's the only difference, which that's more like financial and in status than it is the actual job itself. So when you break down the job that you ultimately want to have, you already have it. That's pretty cool to think about.
Yeah, 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 exactly. I want to have the money to cover all my bills and to be uneasy, like everybody, you know? But I just love comedy. If it was my goal, I just would want to always have that in me, that love of getting up and writing and doing the jokes and going to find a place to do comedy. Like, and there's been probably 10 years, to be honest, for like 10 years where I just, why am I not more successful? You know what I mean? So if I could paint the picture, it would just be to keep, because I have it again somehow. Like, I want to maintain that love of wanting to write more jokes.
So let's attribute it maybe a little bit, probably a combination of things, but let's attribute it a little bit to age and maturation. Yeah, probably like accepting that all these other things that I was letting in the way that were pissing me off and causing me to have ulcers and all this, that wasn't important. Now you're able to say, I'm already doing what I want to do. Let's just keep doing it. And it probably will just grow organically on its own anyway, because your process is only making what you do on stage better.
I'm way more comfortable on stage and in my own head and in my space. I'm probably more sloppy because there's a level of arrogance of like, I'll figure it out while I'm up there, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But
a lot of times that plays better.
Yes.
Than just being sharp.
Overall, it's a difference between sort of being comfortable in your own skin in the moment or being in a script where you know it works best if you pretend to laugh here. Right. You know what I mean? I don't want to do that anymore. I'm one of those guys. I do laugh at my stuff sometimes. I just find myself funny. Yeah.
Right.
That's why I do it.
What's the craziest or funniest story you have about stand up? Because you've been doing it a long time, man. But you were already doing it a long time when I first started doing comedy and met you.
Yeah, so. I've been probably doing it I probably started in 93, so it's 30 years, you know?
A lifetime for most of these listeners, according to the analytics on my page. But
dude, yeah, I got jokes older than you motherfuckers, you know what I'm saying?
So do you have one memory, like just the either the craziest thing or the funniest thing or the most horrible thing?
I don't know, man. I think when you say that, I think of being backstage with Mitch Hedberg.
Oh,
going to the running to the
incredible.
Store and buying him a fan so that he could
wait, you bought him a what?
I went and bought a fan because he was hot in the green room at the Punchline. It used to be like a small, and he was like, do they have a fan, man? And I was like, I don't think so. And so I was like, I'm gonna go get one. So I went and got one in between shows or something, you know.
It's just oh, nice. Was he grateful?
Yeah, he was like, you know, man, thanks, dude, that was cool, you know. But he wasn't, he was one of those guys where it's like a girl that you're trying too hard with.
Uh-huh,
know?
Yeah.
So he had, you know, and you feel that sometimes when you're out, when you're like, there's a young comic that, you know, knows you or likes what you do. It was that, you know. And I remember working with him and sitting there, and Serena, he wore clogs that week. And I remember Serena being like, what's wrong with his leg? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. She's like, it's like wrapped in plastic and tape. What's like, what you could, she could see it sort of on his coming up from his, when his pant leg went up or whatever. And then a couple weeks later was when he got pulled out of line in the insecurity for his bag of whatever he got pulled for. And then when they got him back, that's when they looked at his leg and they were like, holy fuck, we got to get you to a hospital. And that's where he almost lost his leg. Cause that's when he had like gangrene in his leg and a bunch of bad shit was going on. That was right. So it's weird. Like after that happened, it was like, oh, that's why he had that. Cause it was like, getting gangrene and infected and, you know?
Oh, wow. So was he shooting up in his leg? I take it or something?
I don't know. You know, that's what I assume.
Yeah. Wow.
That's not really my place to say, but that's what I assume was happening or, you know.
For whatever reason, yeah, drug abuse was eating away at his leg.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, wow, that's wild.
When I did Last Comic Standing, I did an audition. Like, I was one of the first ones on stage in New York. Went up on stage and did a couple jokes that work every single time. There's just three people sitting back over there. And then I got flustered and I lost where I was and they're like, okay, you can go. And then I was just like, and then it was like, cause then I sat down and did the interview post show. And I remember thinking immediately when I walked out, like, oh my God, I hope there's a guy in a banana suit or a chicken suit. Cause they're going to use me as example of terrible comic, you know? And then my buddy, Jamie Lisso, had a bad set and he was like, he walked off and they were like, can we talk to you? And he goes, yeah, sure. And then he just kept walking and didn't do the post interview. And I was like, God dang it, I wish I'd have thought of that. So if you're a young comic and you're ever on one of these shows and you know you didn't do well, don't sit there and talk about it to them. Leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Great advice. I never even thought about that. Yeah. They're going to use you as the example of the worst act of the night. God damn, that's brilliant. So if you had to sit down. If you could create an opportunity, let's say there's a genie in a bottle, whatever, and you were given the opportunity to sit down and have a coffee or a beer or smoke weed with whatever you're into, with any one person, alive, dead, doesn't matter, maybe both if you want to list them, just sit down for an hour and just shoot the literal shit, who would you pick?
Richard Bach.
Okay, now you're going to have to tell me who Richard Bach is.
I don't know why. He's just an author. I was thinking like Da Vinci or the original Buddha. Like those are the type of people that I like. To me, like that's the Richard Bach is he wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull and some books like One and Illusions, and so those were pretty impactful on me when I was younger, and I just love his sort of metaphysical spirituality, you know, he writes it in a way that makes it feel real to me, even though it's fiction, you know?
Okay.
He'd be interesting to talk to, you know?
Because he is of that, that realm where I'm providing answers to the big questions type person.
Yeah. A guy like Krishnamurti, like these people that sort of, I don't know. I have a weird need to figure out the spiritual connection thing of who we are and what makes us the same, you know, makes me and you a part of the whole.
Yeah. You
know? And I don't think that shit's disputable. So, I have a goal to figure out that connection more and more and more. So those are the people I would want to talk to, I think.
Yeah. Hey, do you have a favorite movie? I don't even know how, I don't think you're a big, huge movie and TV watcher. Is that correct?
Yeah. I find myself, as the older I get now, I'm a lot more emotional when I watch movies and television.
Right? I think me too. I think I enjoy movies better because of it, to be honest. Like, I watched Peanut Butter Falcon. If you've never watched that and you want to laugh and sob your fucking eyes out, watch Peanut Butter Falcon. Like, it's
Peanut Butter Falcon?
Yeah, it's incredible.
I like Jelly Hawk.
Is that the prequel or...
Yes. I like Angeli Hawk.
Right. All right, let's end on this. I know you're a huge baseball fan. Your son's an incredible pitcher with a promising career. You spent a lot of your dad life in a ballpark, sitting inside or right outside of a ballpark. Do you have a favorite baseball movie? Like, did they really nailed it? Because if you're like me, you know, I played a lot of baseball in my life. I fucking hate... You make a movie about baseball. You put some people in there to know how to throw a baseball. Like, I don't want to see some actor that just looks like me throwing left-handed. I don't need to see that. You know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that because baseball movies, they're like movies about stand-up where you think, this will be the one. And they always miss the mark. Yeah. I like Natural. I like Trouble with the Curve. I liked Moneyball. It's probably
movie.
Yeah,
Bull Durham. I thought was really
Bull
good.
Durham was a good one. Yes, those are good ones. Yeah. Things like Damn Yankees and those kind of things were
the Rookie and all these. Oh, Tony Danza. By the way, Tony Danza.
I used to think was one of Angel in the Outfield.
Yes, Angels in the Outfield. I used to think Tony Danza was one of the coolest people on earth because I grew up with Taxi and all these things, and he was a boxer, and, you know, and I'm just like, oh, he's the coolest guy in the world. Until I saw him throw a baseball. You ruined Tony Danza with me by putting him in Angels in the Outfield.
It's amazing. Like sometimes, when you see these actors and you're like, they don't have basic athletic skills where they look like they're the high school jock. And then you watch them, like you said, throw a football or try to catch a ball.
Yeah.
Or,
why are we making Denzel Washington play an actual basketball game? You just ruined it for him. Like he can't shoot he doesn't have good form. Like, come on.
When I see a commercial with a guy, like there's some drug commercial or whatever. And the guy's playing, it's like, look at how he's fielding that ground ball. Like, that's not even, did they not even have somebody out there?
No,
but
basic concept.
I'm amazed by it all the time. Like I said, I've raised a son in baseball, and people that I know are around baseball. And then, like, I'm helping coach a team right now. Like, I was telling the guy that I'm sort of working with, he was at a practice, he was like working, like, all right, we need to work with you guys on your stride and your swing. And I was like, between the two of us, dude, we have three kids at play and none of them can hit. So we're not fixing anybody's swing. Okay. These guys get coached. They have coaching.
They go to hitting clinics.
We can throw BP to them. You know what I mean? We can give them some things, but mostly they're either hitters or they're not, you know?
Right.
I think it happened about 2 years ago with my son, where and it took me longer to realize, like, where I'm still trying to tell him some of the stuff to do. And his knowledge of how his body works and how pitching works and how what he's supposed to be doing, it's past mine, you know? So
right.
I'll be like, hey, you're not getting out front. And you can just see his eyes rolling like, you don't know what you're talking.
Right.
Just, I appreciate it, Dad, but I got this.
It's that way with my son, and it happened probably about at the same age, where he just was just more responsible about life than me. So it wasn't even about baseball. It was just like, I couldn't tell him how to manage his money. He knew I was full of shit and didn't really know how to manage my money. And he knew he was incredibly talented at it. So I stopped being able to give my son advice on anything at about age 20.
Do you have things you wished you would have taught him as younger, like as far as for his character or for his just his mindset, or is there things that you're like, that I assumed I would get that across and I just never did?
I wish I would have been a better role model as like a husband. Like he doesn't even remember like me and his mom being together, but the second marriage I had that lasted like over 10 years was a horrible example of how two people should be living together. So he never got to see from me, hey, this is what
a great example of relationship.
Yeah. He never got that from me at all. He sees it now, you know, but he sees old guy marriage, you know, he doesn't see that from the inside perspective of the son, the young son. So I think he and I'll just go ahead and speak on her behalf. His mom, we failed in that. Like we never really had that one longstanding relationship where he could sit back and go, that's how I need to do it. You know?
Right.
How that will affect him, we'll see.
I hadn't even thought about that, but I think you just put that on my list too.
Yeah. It's a shame that it works in reverse order for us. When our mind is at its best for being a parent, our body is past being at its best as a parent. Like, it's so weird that our body works in the opposite direction of our mind. Cause you know, now at 52, I feel like I could be the perfect parent, but I can't fucking have a kid because I'll be too tired, you know?
Right.
So if I could have that 25-year-old body and this 52-year-old mind, I would be the perfect parent. And that's
isn't it crazy
problem.
How you thought growing up, you'd hear that all the time. Like if I knew now what I didn't know then, like that would be the thing. Like if I could go back, I would want to have the knowledge that I have now with that. And I just hate that. I used to think that's so stupid. Like, what are you talking? You don't know shit. Like I'm going to know less because I'm going to have been programmed more.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. And I get regrets. I get honest regrets a lot now, I find, when I have time to sit and think about it as it pertains to my son, because you know, at 52, I really feel like I am the best version of myself as a human being. But it's only because of all the mistakes that I made and was able to learn from along the way. And that poor kid was right in the middle of the peak of mistake season, you know?
Right. Like, as a matter of fact, he was a mistake.
That's the perfect note to end on. Dude, it was so great getting to sit and talk to you in this format again. So let's not stretch it out too far. Let's have a part two at some point.
Yeah, I really want to talk to you about comedy writing and the script writing classes you're taking, and you're in Stewart's thing with the professor, how that.
Yeah, let's do that on your podcast. Anytime you want, you just book me to be on your podcast. Dumbest Tom in the Room, which, by the way, he's very rarely the dumbest Tom in the room, but I get it. I like the name.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right, brother.
It's good seeing you as always.
Let's talk soon.
Here we go. Here we go.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.